Well, thanks for tuning in, folks. You are listening to The Drew Marshall Show. We're streaming live at drewmarshall.ca. We are on joyradio.ca, and, of course, we're across the GTA on AM 1250. It's been an intense show. Lots of things have happened. We've had frivolity, laughter, cheekiness, seriousness, fatherness-ness.
Thespians, lesbians.
Thespians and lesbians.
Yes.
We've had the whole thing.
All sorts of stuff.
Yeah. Tim, thank you for being with me. How many years now?
A lot.
No, well, the reason I bring that up is because every once in a while you say amazing stuff, and I appreciate it.
Today? I got to have to go back and listen for that nugget.
Oh, boy. Sandra Martin is in studio. She is an award-winning Canadian journalist. She's the author of A Good Death, Making the Most of Our Final Choices. We can't avoid death, but the prospect is a lot less terrifying since the Supreme Court of Canada legalized physician-assisted death.
Or C-14, you were right.
C-14. Or did they? And that's one of the many things we're going to be chatting about in the next few minutes with Sandra Martin. We're playing the theme to Game of Thrones because it seems like in every episode someone dies a beautiful death.
And a horrible death.
And a horrible death, that's
and
right.
And all the cool characters. No one's safe.
Why are you so passionate about this? And when people write about such a divisive issue, obviously everybody wants to know what side you land on. And so for those who've not read the book, what side do you land on? Why are you so passionate about this? Do you have an illness that you will be struggling with soon? Was it just about your father-in-law's journey? I mean, what was it all about?
I'm really interested in people's lives and the choices they make. And I became aware a couple of years ago that people were dying in slightly different ways and they were willing to talk about it. And I was interested in the brave women who came forward in BC, Kay Carter, Gloria Taylor, and participated in the challenge to the prohibitions against medically assisted death. This was an issue that Sue Rodriguez had brought up more than 20 years ago. And, you know, back in the early 90s, the idea that anyone might ask for an assisted death was frankly weird. Mm. But she had an illness, ALS, Lou Gehrig's disease, and she was going to suffer a horrible death. She was going to probably end up choking on her own phlegm. And she didn't want to do that. She wanted to die at a time when, for her, life was no longer tolerable. So she took that challenge all the way to the Supreme Court. And in doing that, we became aware of this issue that was coming out. I mean, other countries were discussing it, but in Canada, it was just a very new idea. And she lost at the Supreme Court in a very narrow decision, 5-4. So the conversation has come up again with the challenge, with what's called the Carter Challenge, where the Supreme Court decided in February 2015 that people who were suffering, had an enduring suffering, it was irremediable, they had a grievous illness or condition, and there was no treatment that was acceptable to the patient that was going to relieve it. People like that should be able to ask a doctor to help them die. It wasn't going to be many people, but it was going to be some people. And that is what the court decided. And now, finally, we have a bill that's been before Parliament. And what we know, I think, is that the people have always been ahead of the politicians when it comes to wanting to have help dying when life becomes intolerable. And now we know that the courts were also ahead of the politicians because Bill C-14 was passed just this week. And what it says is you have to be terminally ill. It was about the bill that passed through the Senate, although the Senate objected to it. It really did provide that sober second thought. Mm-hmm. But finally, it accepted that the elected officials got to have the final say. And now we have a bill that is law, but it is all about dying, not really about suffering.
Since all pain can be, for the extreme most part, controlled by drugs at the end of life, then it's not really about the pain, isn't it? Isn't it more about dignity? In other words, isn't this about people wanting the ability to control things enough so they aren't a drooling, forgetful embarrassment of a burden?
It's not always a drooling, forgetful embarrassment of a burden. I think that perhaps is not an appropriate thing to say. you don't mind me saying.
Yeah, you can say whatever you want. What I'm saying is the people that I know who say, I want the right to be able to end my life, are the ones who are also saying, first of all, there are two sides of this. They say, the group of people that say, I don't want to be in so much pain, so I'd like the opportunity to end my life. And then there are the other group of people that are saying, I don't want to be a drooling, forgetful embarrassment of a burden. That mm-hmm. is a common concept and part of the conversation. Whether it's worded crassly or not, it's not my point. My point is, if drugs can control the pain, then isn't this more about dignity?
A lot of it is about dignity and it's about autonomy. We have the Charter of Rights and Freedoms, and what the Charter is basically about is respecting human autonomy, human dignity, and human choice. So, yes, palliative care, if you have access to it, can control most pain. You can, in fact, be eased into death through palliative sedation, in which you're given drugs, you're put to sleep, and denied hydration and nutrition, and you die. Mm-hmm. Now, for a lot of people, that's just fine. And in fact, we need more palliative care. There are lots of places in this country where you don't have access to that. So I am not against palliative care. But that is not always the choice that people want to have. I think people have to take charge of their own lives. I think this is an opportunity to think about what your choices are, to discuss them with your families, discuss them with your doctors and your lawyers. Find out if I... Ask your doctors, if I were to become really, really sick, would you be willing to help me? And if your doctor says no, then probably it'd be a good idea to find another doctor while you're healthy, rather than waiting until you're sick. But my book isn't just about the last moments of life. Hmm. It's a social history of the right to die movement around the world. Why did this start in the Netherlands, for example? And why was it in Quebec rather than any other part of Canada? And I think that the answers are that this movement takes place in countries or in provinces or in states like Oregon in the United States that are secular.
Yeah, less religious areas.
Less religious, but more leftist, more tolerant, where you can express an opinion more easily. Mm-hmm. So, you know, but I'm not imposing my choice on anybody else. That would be wrong.
Well, you are if you want the country that we all live in to go in the direction in this issue the way that you want.
I don't think that's imposing my choice. I think that that's allowing each person to express a choice. There's no way that I can say to you, mm-hmm. here's what's going to happen to you. You know, you get MS and multiple sclerosis. I'm not going to say to you that you need to apply for physician-assisted death or that some doctor should come around with a
No, you're saying it, but at least needs to be an option for me.
Well, and I think it also, you have to remember what the Carter criteria were. It has to be suffering that is enduring, that is irremediable, that is grievous, and that there is no treatment that is acceptable to the patient. So most people with MS, you know, if you have terminal cancer, it's not good. I mean, nobody would say it was good. Mm-hmm. And you may go through treatment, or you may choose not to go through treatment. It's perfectly legal not to have treatment. Personally, I would always have treatment, but I wouldn't have fifth or sixth round chemo, probably.
Right, right.
But if you have something like multiple sclerosis or Parkinson's or another neurodegenerative disease, or you've inherited the gene for Huntington's, you are likely to spend many, many, many years suffering as your brain remains okay, except with Huntington's, and your body disintegrates. So for those people, some of that is unendurable. It isn't for everybody, mm-hmm. not even everybody with those diseases, but...
Years ago, I asked Larry King if he was afraid of dying, and he said, "You bet your ass I am." Are you afraid of dying?
Well, I'm not dying right now. I mean, in other than the sense that we're all dying sure. to a certain extent. I think that what most people would say, and I probably would say too, it's not death that terrifies you. It's the process of dying. Mm-hmm. Do you want to be unable to speak, hooked up to machinery, unable to take care of yourself? Do you want that? Now, that's a question that you have to ask. And I think that often what happens is as you progress through life, you change your goals. I mean, you can say, oh, that's unimaginable to me. I don't know what your prospect is. Are you afraid of dying?
No.
You aren't. Why not?
Maybe because I've been around it my entire life.
But is it the process of dying that you're afraid of, or the end?
Oh, I'm like any male. I'm terrified of pain. I don't want a needle. But I'm, no, the end doesn't scare me. I could go tomorrow. I'm good to go anytime.
The process of the end.
Yeah, again, from a palliative chaplaincy experience that I've encountered throughout my years as a chaplain, and having worked in various palliative units, there is something about that season that I consider to be one of the thinnest places ever. And I've said this on the show numerous times. C.S. Lewis often talked about the Celts when they talked about thin places, and they would say things like Stonehenge is a thin place, and, you know, geographically this is a thin place. And what they're talking about is the gap between the creator and the created gets really, really thin.
Well,
and as far as I'm concerned, the thinnest place is in that room with that person who is suffering and dying for all of us. So that's one of the reasons I'm not afraid.
You're not afraid of dying, but whether you're afraid of pain, mm-hmm. You've already said you're afraid of pain.
Yeah.
So we can't actually predict what is going to happen to us. We don't know what a diagnosis we might get,
right.
What might happen to us. We might have a catastrophic accident, so that, for example, we're left as a paraplegic or a quadriplegic. Now, nobody would allow physician-assisted death for someone who's just had a catastrophic illness or an accident, because it isn't enduring. It isn't, you know, you've got to have some time to adjust. You've got to have time to talk it through and to think about it. As Stephen Fletcher, the quadriplegic MPP for Winnipeg, mm-hmm. who was a former member of parliament, he said he's the guy who at 23 had a collision with a moose. He was terribly injured. He said, life is the first choice, but it's not the only choice. Mm-hmm. And it would have been some consolation to me while I fought for my life to know that if it became unendurable, I might have a way out. But it is an individual choice. And in my book, a good death is an individual thing. And that's what I'm trying to say. And I'm trying to give people stories, the stories of other people's lives and the experience from other countries. I'd love to tell you about Brittany Maynard if I have time.
Yes, and let me just plug the book first, and then you could tell us about Brittany.
Okay.
A Good Death, Making the Most of Our Final Choices by Sandra Martin. Here's someone at the top named Margaret Atwood, I think, is
Atwood.
Your last name.
Margaret Atwood. You didn't really say that, did you? That was a joke.
Yes.
A timely and deeply felt account of assisted dying, the histories, the issues. My aunt is currently owning and living in Margaret Atwood's old farm up in Mulmer.
Oh, really? Alliston?
Yeah. That's Mulmer County, but yeah.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. She lived there a long time ago. Okay, so what were we going to talk about now?
We're going to talk about Brittany Maynard.
Brittany Maynard. Okay, so she's a 29-year-old woman. She's just married, and she's got these terrible headaches, and it's not from a hangover. She has a glioblastoma, a brain tumor, the same brain tumor that Gord Downie has. Mm-hmm. So she knows what's going to happen to her. She has surgery. She has various things. She is going to have a terrible death, paralyzed, blind, unable to speak, and so on. She lives in California. She and her family decide to move from California to Oregon because Oregon has an assisted dying law for people who are residents and who are within 6 months of dying, although it's always a little hard to predict. Anyway, the result of all that is that she dies with the help of a prescription, 1st of November 2014. So California has been trying to pass a law since 1992. So this is going on and on and on. But the Brittany Maynard story, which was the power of a personal story, really energized everybody in the campaign, Compassionate Choices, and various other advocacy groups in California. And the part I want to tell you about is this bill then passed in the legislature in California, and it was sitting on Jerry Brown's desk. Jerry Brown is the governor of California. He is a Catholic. He was in a Jesuit seminary for 3 years, training to be a priest as a young man. He didn't become a priest, but there he is. He is agonizing over this bill. This is just so hard for him. He talks to Desmond Tutu. He obviously talks to the Maynard family because they're banging on his door every day. And what he finally decides, and he writes this in a letter to the legislators, he says, I tried to think about my own death, and I thought, if I am in pain, and suffering. I would want this option. And if I would want it, how could I deny it to others? And that is the power to change minds. Personal stories, personal experience. And so that bill has just this month is now actually in effect in California. And that's 40 million people, which is the size of Canada.
One person that I think the vast majority of Canadians in the know would appreciate and respect would be Jean Vanier. And I wonder how Jean Vanier would come down on this. Well, I don't wonder. I kind of know. I think most of us would. And so this brings us to the discussion of sanctity of life, because that's the pushback phrase, sanctity of life.
Sanctity of life was the pushback phrase in the days of Sue Rodriguez in the early 90s. Now the same phrase is slightly different. It's called protecting the vulnerable. I'd rather talk not about Jean Vanier, who is very close to God in his idea of God. I mean, he is a wonderful man. He lives his life among people that many people would feel are unfortunate, and he is imbued with a spiritualism and so on and so forth. He had an older sister whose name was I forget her name actually, now that I tell you the truth, but I wrote her obituary as a journalist in the Globe and Mail, and she was also a deeply devout Catholic. She trained as a doctor in England. She became a very prominent hematologist, and then she gave it up to become a palliative care doctor. And she had this amazing ability to talk to patients. And when nothing else can be done, always something can be done. And I believe in that, too. I believe in palliative care. But I don't think it's for everybody, and I don't think it works in every case. And I think that the patient should have some choice. And really what all this is about, and what I'm talking about in A Good Death, is there's a shift going on between doctors being in charge. Mm-hmm. And compassionate doctors have always, at some point, decided, let's just ease this patient out of. Mm-hmm. But it was the doctor's choice. It wasn't the patient's choice. And that's the shift that's happening now. Who controls dying? Is it doctors or is it patients?
Well, I read what Margaret Somerville submitted to the committee that was reviewing all of this, and she suggested that a new profession should be established to carry out euthanasia for the 2,500-plus doctors who understand that euthanasia is not medical treatment. Would you think that a new profession should be established to take care of this? Or should the doctor's hands be forced?
Well, I don't know that it's a question. No, doctors' hands can't be forced because doctors have the right to a conscientious objection.
Right.
That was clearly stated in the Carter.
Right. But as we progress.
As we progress, what do you mean?
Well, as this
I don't think that would be a progression, forcing doctors to. Doctors now don't have to perform a medical operation or procedure that they feel is wrong.
Right. So you're saying that the people responsible to end our lives should be medical doctors?
Well, I mean, suicide is not a crime. I am not advocating that people should commit suicide, but it's not a crime. Mm. For some people, they can't end their lives because they have disabilities. So should they be entitled to a doctor's help? Yes, if they qualify under these criteria. But I don't, you know, there's only a semantic difference between a palliative care doctor giving you morphine that is going to hasten your death, suppressing your breathing, putting you in a coma, and a doctor giving you, at your request, a lethal injection. What is the difference there? Now, some people say it's a difference of intent. I would say it's a difference of intent in terms of who's getting to make the decision, the patient or the doctor. Mm-hmm. And the other difference is it's just a matter of speed, that the suppression of breathing will take longer while the family often stands around and watches. But, you know, this is going to happen in very rare cases where there's going to be medically assisted death. And I think it should always be a difficult decision. Mm. I think it should only be done with great concern, great conversation between patient and doctor.
Well, you say this is going to be rare, but if Canada had the same percentage of deaths by euthanasia as is presently the case in Netherlands and Belgium.
I don't know where your figures are coming from.
I haven't even said any figures.
I know, but I'm kind of waiting for it because I know this comment well.
Right. Well, I've heard that 4% in the Netherlands and 4.6% in Belgium.
4% of what?
Of the population.
No, that's not true.
Okay.
I don't know.
So what is the percentage?
Well, it's certainly not that high.
But how do you know?
Well, I know because they've kept statistics, and those statistics have been published every year. Now, if you had asked me to bring, I can quote statistics from my book if I look it up, but I don't have the statistics off the top of my head. But I know,
do you know where
the
it is in your book?
Argument of the slippery slope was debated and tested in court during the Carter trial, before the Supreme Court decision at the Carter trial. If you give me my glasses, I can look it up. But I mean, I think that there are figures that are bandied about, and there are actual figures.
So you're saying that it's not going to be a number that will ever be a worry to our society, because it'll be so minuscule that we really don't need to worry about it.
Well, I certainly think the numbers are going to go up as the population ages, right?
Exactly.
That's one thing.
So we've got the culmination of the baby boomers dying and then it becoming legal. Those two factors would mean that the numbers would increase substantially. No?
Well, they would have to increase substantially because it's not it wasn't legal.
Right.
So as the population ages and as people get more and more of these progressive, chronic, multiple diseases, but in fact, the there is no ability right now for people to swear out advance directives. There was a suggestion that a patient after a diagnosis should be able to have an advance directive with a doctor. For example, you know, I've got a diagnosis of dementia. I would say to my doctor, if this happens, if that happens, I don't want to be alive when I can no longer speak, no longer take care of myself, no longer recognize my family. That is not allowed. That has not been allowed.
Would you say that conversations about your book, A Good Death, Making the Most of Our Final Choices, Sandra Martin in studio with us, would you say that the conversations about your book often get hijacked by this part of the conversation, physician-assisted death? By the way, is it physician-assisted death or is it doctor-assisted suicide? What are we, is there an official tag that we're putting on that?
Well, the government of Canada calls it medical aid in dying. And in Quebec, that's what it's called too.
Okay.
But you can call it whatever.
But does your book, conversations about your book, get hijacked by this?
No.
Because your book is so much more than just about this.
Yeah, my book so far, I mean, maybe today it will, but so far it hasn't been hijacked by conversations like that.
Yeah.
What most people who've read my book, what they really want to talk about are the lives of people I've interviewed, people whose lives I've talked about, and they want to talk about the historical stuff, the palliative care, the history of that. They want to talk about their own families, their own choices, and they want to talk about the suffering they've experienced or they have observed.
Mm-hmm.
And they want to think about, which is what I'm hoping, is if you want choices, you have to take responsibility. And
it's
that
true.
Means talking to your family. I mean, a great believer, first of all, it's a law, in doctor-patient confidentiality, but talk to your family, talk to your doctors. Do not just decide this on your own. Make sure you've got your family on side.
Three things that have been really tough to chat around the dinner table about have been politics, religion, and death. I think we're in a different society. I think we're in a different time. And I think those three subjects are exactly what people are talking about. Personally, I'm far different than you. I don't give a holy grunt about most political conversations. I care far greater about why people believe what they believe. But I'm the most interested in death because I grew up in the family funeral business, because I have been at the bedside of many who have crossed over, died, whatever thing you want to use. And I have seen the most, I can't get the right word, the most, all I came up with, the most beautiful and impactful moments in my life have been when I'm in a room as someone has died. Last week on our show, we had a lady, her name was Michelle, and she was so moved by the way the funeral home she was working with allowed her to give input as to how the funeral for her 3-year-old daughter was going to go down, that she actually got into the funeral profession because of that. They didn't want the funeral home to come in with a stretcher and the black bag and take the child and throw him into the zip, you know, and cover, and away we go in this black, you know, it's just all sealed. And no, they carried the child into the car.
Yeah, no, a child's death is just, I mean, I find it, you know, I have children. So the idea of my children dying is just something that is horrifying
right,
to me.
Right.
And that is, I don't know that there could be a worse pain for a parent than that sort of thing. But there also are situations where, and this happens often with very premature babies, they're born and they really can't survive. They're born so prematurely that they're resuscitated at 25 weeks or so, and you know, things go wrong, they're just not going to be able to survive. And I have watched and I have been with families where the decision has been made to take them off all the machinery, and the parents just hold and cradle those babies until they die. That can be a beautiful moment. It's much better than to me than just, you know, waiting, I don't know, for the machines to keep cranking on. So yes, death, I think death should be like birth. It is, birth is when you come into this world, death is when you leave it. I don't think it should be done alone, in pain, hooked up to machinery. I think you should be surrounded by those who love you. And so many of us forget that it is a natural process. And we need to talk more about it.
Would you say that, let me rephrase this. Are you frustrated with religious people? Because they've had a say in this issue more than everyone else, I think.
I'm not sure that they have, actually.
No?
And I'm not frustrated with religious people because I don't ever presume that I should be telling people what they should do.
But they have been telling you what to do.
Well, let them, but I'm not going to, you know. I'm
no,
not.
In terms of, you know, I think how you're ending your life.
The Disabled Coalition has also been very powerful. The legal profession has, in some ways, where they're asking, a lot of legal people want a patient who wants an assisted death to have to go before what's called prior review, which is a judicial council. Now, that's totally unconstitutional. So it's not in the law that just passed, but people tried to get it in. I think we have to have faith, and I'm using that word advisedly, in the intelligence and the wisdom of people to make decisions about their own lives.
It is ironic that but just in the context of the latter part of this conversation, that, you know, you have no frustration with the religious people, but the places that are the most advanced, as far as you're concerned, as far as end of life is concerned, are the secularized states or provinces or countries.
Yeah, and there are also the places where you can have an abortion for an unwanted pregnancy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So to me, the math makes sense that there would be some frustration.
I don't know if it's a question of math.
You understand what I'm saying. So I find it hard to believe that...
Do you want me to say that I'm frustrated?
No,
I'm
just saying that... I'm saying that if I were you, being as passionate as...
But of course you aren't.
What I'm saying is, if I were you and I was as passionate about this as you are, and looking at the numbers and looking at the statistics around the world and knowing that the secularized places have the sort of align themselves more with what you think, then it would be kind of an ipso facto, well, what does this really say about the impact religion is having on this issue?
Well, actually, that's one of the reasons I told you the story about California, because the Catholic Church is very powerful in California, as you know, and Jerry Brown, the governor of California, is a Catholic. So I told you that story. I mean, Desmond Tutu is somebody who is really well known as a religious figure, the former bishop of South Africa, and he believes that we should have choice in the way we die, that we should have the option of medically assisted dying for, you know, people who qualify under very strict criteria.
Mm-hmm. This is got to be your biggest work. This has to be the piece you are, maybe are the, well, it doesn't have to be, but I would imagine you'd be the most proud of this book.
It's my most recent book, so yes, I am proud of it.
Well, I think, I don't know. Do you think you were as passionate about all the other ones as you are this one?
I probably was, yeah. I mean, listen, anybody who sits there and stares into a blank computer screen and slogs it out writing has to be passionate about it. So yeah, some of my other books I'm equally passionate about, sure.
Sandra Martin has written for Maclean's Toronto Life, Walrus, Zoomer, Globe and Mail, and Toronto Star, Saturday Night, Weekend, and Canadian. She currently writes the Long Goodbye column for Globe and Mail. Her previous books include Working the Deadbeat, 50 Lives That Changed Canada, First Man of My Life, Daughters Write About Their Fathers, and Card Tricks, Bankers, Boomers, and the Explosion of Plastic Credit. The website is sandramartinwrites.com, sandramartinwrites.com. A pleasure.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
All you need is faith to hear the dealers humming. Don't need no ticket. You just thank the Lord. So people get ready for the train to Jordan. Passengers coast to coast. Faith is the key. Open the doors and board 'em. There's hope for all among those loved the most.
Tori, I have a question for you.
Yes.
Do you have anything you'd like to share with our listeners at this particular point in time?
Indeed I do.
Indeed. Let's see if you can say this all the way through without stuttering once. We're all watching. And action.
Maybe you've been thinking about advertising your organization on the radio, but don't really have the budget for a long-term marketing campaign. Well, what if we gave you an entire show?
Wow, that's a great idea.
The Drew Marshall Show is currently offering an innovative and affordable advertising concept for the small business owner. With web stats and listenership at an all-time high, Canada's most listened to spiritual talk show is offering you the opportunity to partner with us for an entire show. Become a one-day advertising partner, and we'll introduce you to our listening audience for the day. Drew will mention your organization every hour during our four-hour show, and we'll give you a live five-minute phone interview.
Crazy.
Oh, and one more thing.
Yes?
We'll also offer... Sorry. We'll also post your logo and website link on our website for an entire month. So if you're thinking about promoting a special event, product, or upcoming sale, or if you just want to test the radio advertising waters without a huge investment, then consider becoming a one-day advertising partner with the Drew Marshall Show. Contact us through our website, drewmarshall.ca, and ask about becoming a one-day advertising partner.
Good, good. Ladies and gentlemen, Tori the intern.
Yeah!
Yes, well done, Tori the intern. Very well done.
You made it easy for me.
I did make it easy for you.
Oh, man.
I made you start over again.